Ken James and Jason McKittrick. Brought to you by Cryptocurium.
There was thunder in the air on the night I went to the deserted mansion atop Tempest Mountain to find the lurking fear. I was not alone, for foolhardiness was not then mixed with that love of the grotesque and the terrible which has made my career a series of quests for strange horrors in literature and in life.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of Learning Lovecraft. I'm your host, Jason McKittrick, and joining me, as always, the traveler of the Eldritch Path, Mr. Ken James.
Good evening.
And tonight, as always, we are delving into the world of H.P. Lovecraft. Our focus tonight, the Lurking Fear.
The Lurking Fear.
As you heard in that opening passage. Ken, we're headed to the Catskills.
Let's go. I am packed. My vehicle is packed.
Mm-hmm. I need to watch out for those. Gotta watch out for those yokels up there, though. They get weirdness.
They get wacky up there.
Yeah, we know what's gonna happen already. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Lovecraft.
Yeah. I'm pretty well aware at this point what's gonna happen.
Yeah, because I was gonna ask you from that opening paragraph. We already have like a mode already, huh? Like that. We already know what to expect. He kind of tells us right in the beginning, right?
Yeah. He's into weird stuff again. We got another one of these guys. You know,
another one of these. What do they call it in the last story? The epicure of the grotesque or something?
Yeah. I just keep hearing the word Baudelaire in my head, you know?
Sure.
I randomly throughout the day, I'm like, Lovecraft words just pop in my head. And I'm like, what is this guy talking about?
I don't know. Yeah. Voltaire, Baudelaire, the same kind of shit.
Throngs.
Yeah. Obelisks.
I'm sorry. That's another
one. Yeah. No. That's. I think that. That may even be in this story. So this is another one of these. And before we get going, this is another unnamed narrator. So I think before we even get too deep, what's our boy's name?
I like Charlie. Charlie? Like a Charlie?
With the L, the Charlie?
Yeah.
I could go with that. Like he's just randomly from Boston, but he tries to like shed his accent, but every once in a while.
Yeah.
All right. So our narrator's a masshole. Got it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, written in November of 1922, it was first published in January through April, serialized, once again, in the issues of that magazine Homebrew that we encountered for Reanimator. So, this is serialized once again, and we get it, as you'll see as we go forward, it's broken up into four segments. But more importantly, this story was written the same year my house was built, and that just makes me feel kind of cool. Yeah. I don't know. It just gives me a tingle.
It should. it really should.
Yes. So we open up here with our first segment.
The Shadow on the Chimney.
All right. So so Charlie here.
Chuck, this, too. You call him Chuck if you want.
How about we go with Chuck?
All right.
Let's go with Chuck because I feel like we're I don't know. We're stepping on Charlie Emanuel's.
Yeah. Charlie. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I got you. Chuck.
Chuck. I'll go with Chuck. I could do that. So as we hear in the beginning, he has this love of the grotesque and the terrible, which has made his career a series of quests for strange horrors in literature and in life. It's the same, like, this is taking it back all the way to Picture in the House, right? Searchers after horror haunt strange far places.
Yeah.
This is Lovecraft. He's our guy. I mean, he's the guy that wants to poke around, you know, abandoned places, there's an abandoned graveyard with some, the graves are half dug up. Let's do it.
Yeah, maybe put his hand in like a tomb, feel around for the murky bits.
Right. Like it's been put forth that, Lovecraft may have been like a tough hang, but maybe the opposite. Maybe he was like, all right.
Yeah. You got him talking. Once you get him talking,
Yeah.
I'm sure he had a little, curmudgeon in him,
Once you hit his topics, you're golden. But you start talking about anything outside of what he wants to talk about, he's just like, oh no.
Yeah. Mm. This is not going as I expected.
Right. And Chuck here, Chuck tells us about these men that he has with him all the time, George Bennett and William Toby. Quote, men long associated with me in my ghastly explorations because of their peculiar thickness?
Yeah.
What the hell does that mean?
I have no clue, and I was like, but I pictured it.
like, do you think one's like super strong and he's there to like pull the rocks away, and then the other guy's like kind of like, you know, like ganglion, lithe and skinny, like, yeah, right.
Yeah, and he can like squeeze in the tight places, probably. Yeah, the one picks up, can like pick up the stuff, and the other guy can slip in.
Right, exactly. As you do.
Yeah.
So he begins telling us that in 1921, Chuck travels to this Tempest Mountain in the Catskills Range. After there's all these strange reports of these attacks by, I guess these unidentified creatures at this point, they're kind of calling them. They don't know. They're just, these mountain devils, if you will.
Mm. Maybe a wounded ape man? Who knows?
I think we got both in this one, man.
Yeah.
this one hits the high points. These attacks are on these local inhabitants that are, you know, like I said at the beginning, these yokels, and the media gets a hold of it. So a month before, there was this very like unusually large destructive thunderstorm that plagued the area, right. And all these homes were destroyed, seemingly just by the storm. But as they looked closer, the destruction seemed to be left, but it was by some kind of like beast or something. They couldn't understand it, and there's this home that had 75 people like shoved into it, but was completely destroyed and no survivors.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's one of these things where it's like, okay, first of all, ew, 75 mm-hmm. people in one house. And then second of all, a bloodthirsty beast.
Right. And maybe like, are they hiding from something in there? You know,
I don't know, but like the squalor really is on display in this stuff. Yeah. So Chuck does his best to gather the, you know, information from these locals, and he starts hearing these legends about this family and this mansion, the Martens mansion and that family.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an old Dutch house that was built long time ago. I mean, they even go into it later that this is built before even like the British were even had hold over the area.
Yeah.
But it's just, there's this mansion, it's up on the top of this mountain, and no one really goes up there. The police apparently don't even patrol it. They're just like, it's just an old mansion. So our guy gets the idea one night. He wants to go up there, and he brings his two boys. What was it? George and William.
Yes.
George and Bill. And there's about to be another thunderstorm. So they're like, well, there seems to be kind of correlation with the thunderstorms and these beast attacks.
Yeah, so we're it's right time.
Yeah, big time.
Big time.
And, you know, he does a little bit of study about all this, and he figures out that the best room that he can go to is this, the room of the main guy that used to live there, Jan Martens. He's like, I'm going to go in his bedroom. They have this whole thing set up, which is kind of interesting, where it's like, all right, we have, like, ladders that go out, like, the one window. So if the thing comes from inside, we can escape this way. And if it comes in the window, we can go out the stairs. They're all set up. But what doesn't make sense to me is that immediately they're sitting in this abandoned house, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're scared there could be some kind of monster, and they decide to lay down. And
yeah,
kind of. I mean, I see why. Like, I can see the literary device, like where he was going, because then like what happens right after this. But like, watching in shifts, why are you laying down? Why don't you just? Why isn't like one dude at one window with one gun, another guy at the other window with another gun?
Yeah,
and, like I don't know.
I think it more has to do with maybe Howard himself not knowing how these things actually work, you know?
I think you're onto something there.
Right. I think it's more of just like, what would we do? Probably have a lay down, you know? Like,
Definitely not. I mean, anytime you go into these places, you're not laying down. You don't want to sit on anything.
Yeah, yeah. If you lay down, if you're in one of these older buildings that are decrepit, mm-hmm. you're probably going to lay down in some glass covered in piss.
Yes, not probably, definitely.
Yeah, yes.
So as I mentioned, I mean, these guys, they decide to like watch in shifts, but they all fall asleep, which is insane to me, but okay.
Yeah.
So Chuck wakes up and he discovers that both of his companions are missing, he thinks, and there's an arm across his chest, a strange arm.
Yeah.
And we get this next passage.
That I'm still alive and sane is a marvel I cannot fathom. I cannot fathom it. For the shadow on that chimney was not that of George Bennett or of any other human creature, but a blasphemous abnormality from hell's nethermost craters. A nameless, shapeless abomination which no mind could fully grasp and no pen even partly describe. In another second, I was alone in the accursed mansion, shivering and gibbering. George Bennett and William DeBay had left no trace, not even of a struggle. They were never heard of again.
Yikes.
Yeah, so he gets this flash of lightning, and there's this shadow that it's not his buddy. It's this creature, right? And all the while, he kind of comes to the realization that it's like that arm that was on him was not his two pals.
Right. I have a creature that's...
Yeah. Yeah.
That's lurking right now.
Yeah, there's a lurking fear right there.
Yeah.
and, you know, he comes to the conclusion, it was sleeping next to him? Ew.
Yeah.
And what it's is like, that about?
And it's like cuddling with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, not,
super
not
weird.
Cool, man.
I mean, it gives me the willies. I mean,
sure.
It's...
And that kind of could be that, like, you know, the device to get it to, like, oh, the, you know, it's like this is warm.
Like, did off. He ripped up his two buddies. He's got a full belly. He's like, you know, it's time for a nap. And then he lays next to the other guy. So I was going to eat that third guy, but I'm full.
He's, you know, he eats the other two, and he's like, oh, this guy's got the right idea. And he just, you know, gets in there, nestles in.
Yeah, Chuck, you know, I don't know what he was thinking.
I don't either, bro.
Well, that's the first encounter with the lurking fear for old Chuck here, and that concludes you know part one of the story. So the next serialized chapter is
A Passer in the Storm.
So our pal here he's not doing so well after that, hanging out in his hotel, can't get out of bed.
Yeah. Worrying if he's gonna, like, you know, wake up with another strange arm around him.
Yeah, I mean, once that happens to you,
you think it's always gonna happen to you at that point.
Right, right. And for some reason, I remember reading this first time, I thought the creature was Fluffy from the crate from Creepshow.
Yeah,
I was like,
oddly enough, like, because like I after I read them,
yeah,
when I'm on my way to record, I'll find, like, a, you know, an audio telling on
right.
YouTube to listen
good
to
idea.
While I drive, you know,
yeah.
Just to keep it fresh when I get there.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, people's, like, drawings of this, you know,
yes.
Like, it's like, I don't know. I don't know if that's what it turned out to be.
Let's save that to the end.
Right.
No, good point. I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah.
So Chuck continues his investigation. And he finds this pal, this guy, this other journalist that's staying at the hotel, a gentleman by the name of Arthur Monroe. And what's funny about this dude is he's described as a dark, lean man of about 35 whose education, taste, intelligence, and temperament all seem to mark him as one not bound to conventional ideas and experiences. So right off the bat, I was like, oh, it's Spencer Strider.
Okay, yeah.
All right, he gets killed.
Yeah, and he's like, strangely tight pantaloons, the man.
Exactly.
Wearing.
Yep. Hey, shave that mustache.
Sorry. Yeah, you're good.
Yeah.
You're good.
And so he tells him, so Chuck tells Spencer, Arthur, what happened, and the guy's like, yeah, totally. I could see, you know, that's crazy. And so he's like, all right, he's in. I got a new guy to hang out with.
Right.
Another ghoul artist guy to come hang out with me and pick through rubble with.
Right.
So they start working together, and the two, you know, they scour the countryside for clues to, you know, anything about these creatures or any possible remains or stories, you know, related to the Martens family. No trace, nothing at this point, but they do happen to come across this ancestral diary, which will become important in a little while.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is at this point that Chuck tells us that he's starting to get this constant feeling of being watched, which is never a good sign.
That old chestnut, you know?
I'm sure it's not going to come into anything. So him and Monroe are trapped by this thunderstorm during one of their, you know, gallivanting episodes.
Gallivanting escapades.
Yes. There's a huge thunderstorm, and they come to this area where it's where all these, like, all these locals have made, like, this, they call it, like, a village, but, like, he even says it's, like, it's not really a proper village, because it's, like, made out of, like, you know, pallets and just, like, slapdash put together. It's just, you know, there's probably a I don't know, a moonshine still in the back. I don't know.
Yeah. And some guys always like, you gotta make sure your liquor. And, you know, they all, your liquor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They probably make great stew.
People like stew.
I've heard that.
I've heard that as well.
So they get into this little hut. They're waiting for the storm to pass, and it's like violent, right? They even make the point where it's like it's middle of the afternoon and it's like black. They have to like turn on their they put their lighters out a few times. They're sitting there smoking their pipes.
Like
as
you
do. You do.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, he's sitting there thinking about the whole thing, and it's really starting to freak him out because he's like, oh, this, you know, I'm sitting in this dark area, the flashes of the lightning, or it's making me think of the first time I these the, you know, the creature. And I'm not really into it.
Yeah, he's like, I'm really creeped out here.
Yep.
This doesn't seem right.
No. Why would you be? But his pal Monroe, you know, he sees that the storm's about to pass. So he walks over to the window, and he opens the shutters and leans out to take a look. And then we get this great little sequence here.
Yeah.
Suggesting to Monroe that we had better get some light, even if more showers came, I unbarred and opened the crude door. The ground outside was a singular mass of mud and pools, with fresh heaps of earth from a slight landslide. But I saw nothing to justify the interest which kept my companion silently leaning out the window. Crossing to where he leaned, I touched his shoulder, but he did not move. Then, as I playfully shook him and turned him around, I felt the strangling tendrils of a cancerous horror whose roots reached into illimitable pasts and fathomless abysms of the night that broods beyond time. For Arthur Monroe was dead, and on what remained of his chewed and gouged head, there was no longer a face.
And just like I said on our last episode, he has such a way of describing, like, almost ancestral fear.
Yes.
And he does, like, he'll do it in a big way or a small way. Mm-hmm. The last story, he did it in a small way. This time, he did it in a big way.
Yes. Yes, because I'll save it for the conclusion, but like the language in this is very different from our last outing with the hound. I think we'll get to it at the end. So, yeah, man, his boy sticks his face out and that's it.
Yeah. Curtains.
Yep. Just ripped right off. So, you know.
That happened.
And that brings us to the end of section number two. You know, because what a way to end a section.
Yeah.
And then we're brought to segment number three.
What the red glare meant.
So, after this happens, after horror number two occurs.
Yeah.
He spends weeks really trying to delve into the family history of the Martins. Because he's got to get to the bottom of this. He wants to know, what is this? Is this some kind of like ancestral curse? Is this some kind of like creature? Is this Jan Martens himself coming back to like haunt the area?
Yes.
You know, what is it? He can't figure it out. and he really thinks that it's, you know, that it's going to be, this is where he's going to find his answer. So he learns about this. He learns about the mansion, very old, built by the first Martens to come to, not the United States yet, but New Amsterdam. And Martens, Garrett, was really not into the British. So much so that he pulls away from all that and essentially tells his family that, you know, nope, no British stuff for us. We're doing our own thing. And, you know, they closes himself off from the rest of the society. And Lovecraft gives us this little chestnut of, in appearance, all were marked by a peculiar inherited dissimilarity of eyes, one generally being blue and the other brown. So we get this marker of this family. They all kind of, you know, it's called heterochromia.
Yeah, they're like one, huskies.
Yeah, kind of. I believe they talk about it at the beginning of X-Men First Class. You can watch it if you want to. But yeah. Nice. James McAvoy is the lurking fear.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this family, all of them apparently have one blue eye and one brown eye. I don't think this will.
It was Patricia.
I don't think this will factor later in the story either. So it's no reason to even mention this.
It was just something he threw in there for color.
Yeah. So we're given the whole shebang behind the family here. We get, you know, isolated from the outside world completely. Then they start going into the whole, they're intermarrying. You know, you've got these weird like intermarrying with the families, and then like they're mixing with the mountain men, and then like some are staying, but then you have this like core group that's just staying near the mansion. And it's this whole just inbred kind of society that's like occurring there. They're completely, you know, they've got their own, almost like their own speech too. They kind of mention.
Yeah, they're like basically at this point they're like Ewoks. It's like Endor out there, you know.
Utini.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, yes. But he's you know, they're all like living around this, you know, mansion like it's a base kind of.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah.
They're just like lurking in the trees and just like got people on spits that they're just spinning over fires.
Probably.
Warwick Davis plays one of them.
You know what? Probably. I mean, and you know what? Why not?
Yeah.
It's a strange whole scene going on over there. But remarkably, we fast forward to young Jan Martens, who is struck by, you know, this unusual restlessness among the Martens, and he decides to join the colonial army during the Revolutionary War. And, you know, he does this thing. He goes out and he goes out to war, and he's gone for 6 years. And when he comes back, his family basically views him as an outsider, and they hate him.
Yeah.
And you know, he keeps correspondence with one of his buddies, a guy named Jonathan Gifford. He says to him, he's like, look, they don't like me here. He's like, I got to get out of here. You know, they're you know, they don't even want me in the house. They treat me like a complete stranger. I'm too British for their tastes.
They told me to give me one of my eyes.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to wear shoes. They don't like it. I don't pee inside. It's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, carpet peeing. They're into it.
I'm the only one with an innie. Here. Right.
Okay. All right. Weird detail, but probably.
That's why they hate him the most.
It could be.
They're all like freaks with outies, you know?
Ooh. And the two different colored eyes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd stay away from them.
Yeah, right. You're like, all right. Something's up here. I'm not into this.
Yeah. So, they tell us that the correspondence soon stops, and his pal Jonathan, you know, he gets curious. He's like, you know, I want to go check on my pal, and he goes out to the mansion in 1763, and he tells him that he says that the mansion is just in this unbelievable state of like squalor, like it's falling apart, it's gross. The family is, they can barely speak. It's all like grunts.
Yeah.
It's not good. It's very Arthur German at this point.
Yeah, he's like, and for some reason, Chris Walken there is like, five generations of large family breeding, you know?
Inbreeding.
Yeah, right. Ow!
Yeah, exactly. But they give him this nonsense that, you know, oh, Jan's dead. He was struck by lightning during a thunderstorm. Mm-hmm. And this dude's like, no. So he asks to see where he's buried, and he digs him up.
He's like, it's like, people feel that most people will sympathize with our situation. What is our situation, Dad?
Sorry.
Yeah. Had to
get it. One of them was probably a painter.
Yeah. Toddy. Come on, Toddy.
Yeah, so he digs up the grave and he finds that his skull, it says that his skull was crushed cruelly, if by savage blows.
Yeah.
And, you know, his family murdered him because he was too much of an outsider, which, you know, it's kind of terrible.
The concept, like, I would think any kind of blow is a savage blow, if you know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
I guess a little less savage would be like a baseball bat indentation, just like one maybe. That's a little less savage.
I think I get what you're saying, but I think they're kind of, I think he's going down the road of like, oh, he didn't fall off his horse and his head got, it's like he looks down and this dude's head is just gravel.
Yeah, it's concave. It's like, it's like the German family showed up and were just like, rrr, rrr.
Yeah. Good thing there's no those weird white apes in this story.
Yeah, right.
It really got weird.
Yeah. It'd be a sick fight, I'll tell you what. Never mind, we'll talk about that later.
Oh, yeah. Ding, ding. Yeah. So Jonathan goes out and he basically spreads the word about these guys. I mean, there's not enough evidence to like get them convicted or anything. And let's be honest, nobody wants to go up there anyway.
Yeah.
But their neighbors, you know, they hear about all this, so they become completely shunned at this point. Now the Martens family, nobody talks to them, nobody, nothing, and they're completely just, that's it. And this is where the real like period of like degradation like occurs, and Lovecraft tells us that, you know, the only signs of continued existence was like, you know, the last time, like 1810, like a light was seen in one of the windows, and that was the last time. And then in 1816, a posse searched the mansion and discovered that everyone was gone. Like there's weird things just like missing, you know, just scattered around. Like the furniture's missing, but there's like utensils on the floor. Like just weird, you know, they're just
glass
gone.
Covered in piss.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Matted fur.
Yeah.
Bananas.
Bananas. Yeah.
And you know, this great ancestral home, you know, it's you know, completely just, you know, fall into complete disarray. And then like I like there's the detail he gives us that there's improvised additions. Like they had built onto it. But like you imagine like this stately manor and there's like tree houses like nailed to the side of it.
Yeah. There's like a crudely like booby trap like rope log.
Yeah.
That just like will drop down and hit you in, you know, in the stomach.
So after learning all this, Chuck, he's got to go back. He needs to figure this out, man. I mean, you know, if anything, just to, I don't think he has any kind of honor. It's not like, well, I have to avenge the deaths of my friends.
No.
He's curious. He's got to know. And at this point, I think this guy's probably starting to slip into madness a little bit because
I would say
Why would you go up there alone? You know that there's the threat of death.
Doesn't he at one point? Isn't he like talking about like how like. It kind of took everyone else, but not him.
Right.
But there must have been some kind of reason for that, you know?
He's the Slytherly D.
Yeah.
Killed the others, but he didn't eat me.
Yep.
So Chuck finds his way back to Jan Martens' grave, and he decides to dig into it. There's nothing in there. He kind of knew there wasn't going to be anything in there. But as he's digging, he falls through into what appear to be a tunnel underneath the coffin.
Yeah, the whole thing's honeycomb.
Yeah.
No, okay.
And he drops into this tunnel and he looks both ways. He's got his little flashlight and he sees that it just goes off into both directions, seemingly without end. So once again, either being very brave or very crazy, he climbs in and just starts climbing one way.
Yeah.
It just starts going, and they say that the time passes, like he doesn't even know how long it goes. And he gets to a point where he's going and then it goes up sharply. So he starts to climb a different way. And then we get this next passage.
I had been scrambling in this way for some time, so that my battery had burned very low when the passage suddenly inclined sharply upward, altering my mode of progress. And as I raised my glance, it was without preparation that I saw glistening in the distance two demonic reflections of my expiring lamp. Two reflections glowing with a baneful and unmistakable effulgence and provoking maddeningly nebulous memories. I stopped automatically, though lacking the brain to retreat. The eyes approached, yet of the thing that bore them I could distinguish only a claw. But what a claw.
What a claw.
So I like that. I mean, he's shining in the darkness, and the eyes of this thing, you know, the reflection of his flashlight is the eyes of this creature.
Yeah.
And he's able to see it a little bit more, and then he just sees this clawed hand. It's gross.
To add, like, just insult to injury, it's like you're already spelunking. Like, what a terror.
Yeah.
What a horrible thing.
Yeah. This is like the descent in miniature.
Yeah. And then he runs into this creature, underground monster.
Yep. And he's sitting there staring at it. And luckily, he's kind of saved by this sudden lightning strike, which, you know, scares the thing off. And he's allowed to quickly escape. And then he sees this distant red glare, which days later, he finds out that there was this cabin that was set on fire. And they burn these creatures on the inside, which is, you know.
Fortuitous.
It kind of blows the thing wide open for him.
Yeah.
And so he goes and investigates and finds out that during the same time that he was in the ground, there was another attack by these monsters, creatures, and it happened at the same time that he was there. So he quickly realizes, oh shit, there's more than one of these things.
Yeah.
Because there couldn't be, this couldn't possibly have happened, you know, it was literally exactly the same time because he saw the fire in the sky. He was able to see that. And so, you know, it's worse than he could have possibly imagined.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lurking fear, all right.
I mean, it is lurking for sure. So this brings us to part four.
The horror in the eyes.
So Chuck just can't get enough, man. So he returns once again to Mortensa's grave. And, you know, he finds that burrow that he made last time there under the grave that is completely caved in. So he decides to, like, investigate the entire area. And, like, he's on top of this hill and he observes kind of, like, the whole area. And he kind of clicks that, wait, these aren't, like, there's, like, these mounds. He's like, these are, like, mole tunnels. And he sees, like, he can tell that, like, they all kind of radiate out almost like tentacles from the mansion.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like this funny little thing that happens here that, like, he kind of goes nuts and, like, starts running around. Like, they say he's even, like, laughing a little bit with a shovel. And he's, like, going around digging and then running. And it, you know, our boy's kind of lost it at this point.
Right. Yeah, he's, Chuck's out of it. He's bushwhacked now, you know.
Yep. So he comes to the mansion and he sees this, you know, he sees this area that's right below the chimney area of the main chimney area. And he sees that there's this break in the bottom of the chimney. And this seems to be where the tunnels kind of like all intersect. So, and there's an approaching thunderstorm. So he's like, all right, this has to be where they're coming out of. So he sees an area. He already knows his sanity slipping, but he sees an area to hide, goes behind this bush and waits. And he's like, I don't know what I'm going to see.
But I'm here for it.
Yeah. So as he's sitting there, the thunderclap happens and this mass of flesh and fur, almost like rats, but way huger, just emerges from the bottom of this chimney. And, like, you know, in typical Lovecraft mode, the description is non-description, right? Where it's like, you know, no pen could ever, you know, describe the horror of this kind of thing. And as he's going, there's this one kind of like cool little part that happens where he sees one of them and he gives the description first, where he's like, they're kind of like these, you know, they're dwarfed like apes, almost white with yellow fangs.
Yep.
And the first one that he's able to kind of see, like, there's like a weaker one next to him and just like turns, just eats him. And I was like, oh, that's great. Yeah. And like, so they're just these, you know, these simian cannibal underground mole
slowly
things.
They've slowly like wore away their hierarchy of like emotion, that their brains shut off because of like malnourishment and like lack of vitamin and sunlight and sustenance, and they're just like
and you know, so he's wondering, where are these things coming from? What are they like? What, why are they under the Martin's house? How did these things get there? And so he's, you know, he's got that, you know, that mind of like, well, you know, he has his pistol and he waits for a thunderclap to occur. And when the thunderclap happens, he shoots one of them. And he walks over to it to examine it. You know, it gives the full description. It's this ape-like beast. We get this final passage here.
What I saw in the glow of my flashlight after I shot the unspeakable straggling object was so simple that almost a minute elapsed before I understood and went delirious. The object was nauseous, a filthy, whitish gorilla thing with sharp yellow fangs and matted fur. It was the ultimate product of mammalian degeneration, the frightful outcome of isolated spawning, multiplication, and cannibal nutrition above and below the ground. The embodiment of all the snarling chaos and grinning fear that lurk behind life. It had looked at me as it died, and its eyes had the same odd quality that mocked those other eyes which had stared at me underground and excited cloudy recollections. One eye was blue, the other brown. They were the dissimilar Martin's eyes of the old legends, and I knew in one inundating cataclysm of voiceless horror what had become of that vanished family. The terrible and thunder-crazed House of Martins.
Yeah, so here's what I love about that, right? It leaves you to wonder, like, how fast the process was. Were they always kind of like this?
Yeah.
And only one of them kind of wasn't, you know? Like, it was born, like, he's all right.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, first of all, I think it's, like, they're Dutch that didn't like English people. So, first of all, Lovecraft's like, oh, forget them. So they must be some kind of beasts of some sort. But what is this, 2 centuries, maybe?
Right.
Yeah, about 2 centuries, maybe 2.5. Then 2 centuries, because 1810, they're already starting to go slide down the, you know, this is 1921, not even 2 centuries. That happened pretty fast.
Yeah, so they must have already been kind of...
Yeah.
Jan was a little weird, you know?
Well, Jan was the good guy.
Oh, I'm
they
sorry,
didn't
not
like
Jan.
Him.
Sorry,
the original guy, Garrett.
Yeah. Garrett, yeah, that's him.
He must have started old insanity.
yeah. But,
you know, you could, because, you know, if you know any of the, you know, Lovecraft's later stories, or if you just know the ones that you've read so far, your brain kind of tries to go to some kind of, like, well, are they worshiping something down there? Is there something in the earth that's, like, changing them? Like, that's fast. I mean, like, you know, a de-evolution, that takes, you know, millennia. So it's like, what the fuck are they doing down there? And I think that's the fun thing. Like, that's the fun main thing for me for this story.
Right, and I was thinking, like, did the lightning wake them all up? Was it, like, hitting that tree? And, like, that was, like, just sending, like, shockwaves through the earth and, like...
Yes, because they say the first, the Garrett Martens, he couldn't stand how loud the thunder there was, so he would go down in the basement to escape the sound.
Ah, yeah.
So, so it's, like, something, like, that's where I get, like, that's, you know, it's like, all right, so what happened? He went down in the basement. What happened down there? You know, did he go down there and just lose his mind and, like, that kind of, like, that, like, created something? You know what I mean? Like, his insanity down in the basement.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, or is it some other thing where it's like the lightning would drive him nuts, so he would go down in the basement, but something existed down there already?
Or he was down there and it wasn't good enough, so he started digging.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I mean. Like, man, he dug and he found something. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Something that altered them. So it's completely left hanging. You know, you don't really get to know anything else. You just know that, you know, this thunder-crazed House of Martens, that the thunder is the thing that always kept them stirring, right?
Right, like, right.
They'd be down there trying to rest, whatever it is that they're doing down there. I imagine that they're all just, like, huddled together, like, you know, you ever see those, like, videos of rats that they're just packed at, like, thousands of them in just, like, a thing.
Yeah, and that's how they came out of the fucking fireplace.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, what the fuck are they doing down there? And maybe nothing. Maybe they just sit down and they just huddle, and it's just some kind of, like, you know, maybe
sleep.
Some kind of commentary from Lovecraft about how these, you know, these types of people just pack together and just huddle, and, you know, they're only moved out by, you know, big, you know, forces of God or something.
And that would make sense, him, like, cuddling up to him when he's sleeping, you know.
Right. He likes to cuddle.
Yeah.
These things like to snuggle. I mean, they're ferocious beasts, but they're not, you know, they're not above some cuddling.
Yeah, they're not all bad.
Well, you know, the matted fur, I mean, you know.
Yeah, that could be nice. But one of the things that I actually, it's funny, his buddy that he buried, that he met, and he didn't want to, like, scare all, like, the villagers.
Yes.
It's that old thing that my buddy Boyd used to say, like, if we were at a party and something broke, you just steal it, because better lost than broken.
Yes. Because then, like, yeah, right, yeah. You don't have to apologize for it.
Yeah, and then they won't even remember.
I don't know where it is.
Yeah, and, like, people are like, where is it? Oh, I don't know. That's weird. So better lost than broken. Just bury the body.
Yeah, just bury the body. Like, oh, his pitching was getting slow anyway.
He was injured. He was injured. He can't.
Right. Nice thighs.
Yeah.
Sorry, folks. No. So I mean, and that's the story. You know, this is one of those ones, man. That it's like, we're definitely hitting that stride, right? We're trying to hit this mode where, like, you know, you start it and you kind of know where we're going, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now, who do you think would win in a fight? The Germans or the Martens?
Well, there's way more Martens.
Yeah, but, dude, the Germans
one-on-one?
Are gorillas.
Are we talking about one-on-one?
One-on-one, the Germans are taking them. But I'm saying you'll
for
have,
sure.
You know, the one will be like a bruiser, just, like, knocking them out like it's Lord of the Rings. You know what I mean? Like,
I think it would almost be like the fight between the T-Rex and those two Velociraptors at the end of Jurassic Park.
good call.
Like, good you get call. Two more tens trying to, like, rip up the T-Rex's neck, but then they're like, all right, enough of this. And he just whips the one off and crushes the other one.
Yeah.
And then he jumps off the boat and swims onto the island and he's never seen again. Where are these movies, Hollywood?
Yeah. Yes, they have the worst ideas.
It's Kong versus Godzilla. I want the Germans versus the Martens. What are we doing here?
Dropping the ball, apparently.
For real.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. So, you know, what did you think? How'd you like this one?
I loved it. And like I was saying, when I was listening to it driving down, all the parts with the thunderstorms, it was thunderstorming when I was on my way down.
Oh, beautiful.
Oh dude, it was so good. Mm-hmm. I was like, this kicks so much ass. And it did. It was great when I was like re-listening to it. No, it's a great one. It has, you know, adventure. It's got the mystique. It's right. And you get beast creatures. So like, what's to not like?
Right. I'm right there with you. It's got a lot of great atmosphere, and it's one of those ones that like I love them all, but sometimes the language gets in the way. And this one, like halfway through reading it again, I was like, does the language get in the way? Because he is Mr. Description in this story. It's like I love it, and he's really trying. He's really turning a phrase here and there. I mean, it's like there are so many like, you know, of these like sentences that just trail off into this, but I think that's kind of on purpose. I mean, you know, sometimes I think he does these things in his stories where he almost like mirrors what's going on in the story with the way that he constructs his language, where it's almost like these passages of text become almost like the tentacle tunnels that are, you know, catacombing off from this thing. You know what I mean? It almost becomes like a representation of the thing in the story.
And I don't know if this is just because I've read so much at this point, but I think this one was much more easy to follow, even though the language was the way it was.
Right.
Even though it was what I just think this, the kind of the there was a mystique, but he didn't get too crazy. It was laid out and like, yes, there is a lot of description, but it's not like a description about like, I don't know. It's not like intertwined with like the place and this and that. It's just like, it's straight up. It's a description. And he uses a lot of words that are just add depth to locations or people, you know what I mean? Right. Or feelings.
Oh yeah, sure.
Whereas like other times I'm like, wait, what is this guy saying? You know, like, but no, this time it was, like I said, it was pretty straightforward and not much to ponder really.
You know? Yeah. And I was also going
to
say,
well, I'm sorry, not much to ponder besides the stuff that he doesn't get in depth with, you know what I mean?
Like, sure.
He gives you what he's giving you. The rest is, you know, up to you.
And I think, and that's what I was going to talk about as well. I think that this also has the same kind of thing that occurs with Reanimator, where this was serialized. So like it forced him to kind of like chop his stuff up a little bit and make it a little more digestible, because it was going to be, you know, it was serialized. And I think that's kind of like what makes this one a little more like punchy, where it's like each section has like a little like cliffhanger-ish kind of thing going on. And I think that works well for him, because that also like, you know, His stuff is wonderful, but like, you know, editors could have really helped him out with some of his stuff. So the ones that were made, that were written specifically for a serialized thing, as opposed to stories that like, oh, I wrote this, please publish it. There's definitely a different thing going on. Sometimes I think it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I really like this story. There's something really strange about it. I like the whole backstory of this family that just degrades. Yeah, I love it. And there's, you know, more monkey creatures.
I feel about the monkey creatures. I'm all in on them. So who you got a casting idea for Chuck here?
Oh, so I was thinking a few of them, and I just kept coming back to Crispin Glover.
I like it. I do like it. It's good. No, because he's quirky. Yeah. I have a younger Tim Robbins, like Andy Dufresne style Tim Robbins.
Oh, so like Jacob's Ladder Tim Robbins.
Yeah, like that look to him, you know.
Yeah,
like
I could dig that.
Like
I like that,
because you know when he does his like, you know, when he's like gets that like, you know, 50 yard stare going, and he's
yes
and he puts it on, and like, and then when he like obsesses over stuff,
yeah,
he's like thinking like, how could you be so obtuse, you know, like that kind of like just like that mode that he gets into. You could see him like really like getting into the thought process, and then he's like, honeycombed, you know, like it's like,
Molehills.
Yeah, molehills. You know, yeah, I would like, I like both of our answers. I think, dude, we do good on these.
I think we did good. I mean, I know that they just used Crispin Glover for the Pickman's Model adaptation for that shitty Guillermo del Toro thing. But I think he works well for a lot of Lovecraft stuff. But that's just me, I guess.
No, no, he's got the look, and he's got the eccentric, you know, wackiness to him.
Yeah, yeah. Way, I think it worked way better with this than Pickman's Model. But we haven't read that yet, but we will soon.
Yeah, so, I have no clue, what that is.
No, you're gonna love that one too. So there are two film adaptations of this story.
Really?
Yeah, there's a Full Moon Entertainment release from 1994 called The Lurking Fear. It is terrible, and we are going to watch it.
Okay.
It's terrible in that way that you'll like it. Okay. And then, this is new to me, I just came across it when I was researching for this episode, there was one that came out in 2023 called The Lurking Fear. Very, very loosely based, but it's got Michael Madsen in it, and all right. I have to watch it. He's because like, he is pure shit now.
Yeah, he's like,
his voice is almost gone.
I don't even know. You're dying in that. He's like Tom Waits now.
Yeah. Kind of. they're both loosely based, but you know, we're gonna have to watch these and report back or something.
Yeah, I'm down.
Something.
I'm in.
Yeah, I know you. So yeah, so that's The Lurking Fear, man. Another
One last thing before we leave. The descriptions that, and the pictures that people
have drawn
of these. I'm like a lot of them are like big dragon creatures. It's like
there's a lot because like I think people get caught up in some of his like odd like we were talking about his odd like strings of words that he gets into, and he even uses words like someone said a snake. Someone said a devil. Somebody said just a creature. And I think they see that and they're like, oh, snake? Okay, so it's a snake.
Yeah, like, or like they base it off that, and when it gets to the end, they're like, no, I don't even care.
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever.
Yeah, I mean, whatever.
It's whatever you want it to be.
Yeah, I made up my mind.
Yeah. There are, most of the time you get something close to, you'll get like, you know, apish looking creatures, but then sometimes you'll get some very weird ones where there's one cover that somebody did for something. They look like mole people. I'm like, yeah, it's not what he says it is.
No.
So he's pretty descriptive at the end. Just Howard likes white apes.
Yeah. That he does.
So, you know, I'm not going to deprive him. He says that's what it is. That's what it is.
That's what we're going with.
Yeah, it's canon.
Over here at Learning Lovecraft.
It's LL canon.
Truly.
Ken.
Yes.
Next episode. Mm-hmm. We are covering perhaps the first of his great stories.
Okay.
The Rats in the Walls.
Okay, you've been talking about this. You're hype on this, man.
This is a huge story. There's a lot to contend with in the story. This is going to be either a very big episode or a two episode one. I'm not sure. We're going to see where we get to. But this is a big one. This is where Lovecraft discovers a big part of who H.P. Lovecraft is.
Okay. Are there rats in walls?
Yes, but that's not even, that doesn't even cover it. Yeah.
Maybe we'll just do a new segment going when you like tell me it and I try to guess what's going to happen.
Let's start that right now. What do you think is going to happen in The Rats in the Walls?
The Rats in the Walls, it's probably going to be like thoughts in his brain. The rats in the walls are probably going to be don't tell me I'm wrong. Just like, let's just go with it, you know?
Okay. Thoughts then, in his brain. Yeah.
Like the rats in the walls, you know, he's going crazy. I don't know. No. Here we go. I got you. It's like the people under the stairs.
You know what? That's not bad. That's not bad. An oversimplification, but that's not bad.
All right. We'll go with that. That's what I'm guessing.
That's not bad.
All right.
And before we get to that story, if you're following along with us, folks, yeah, we know what the cat's name is. All right, so relax. Ken has no idea.
I don't. I'm just laughing because he's got a big old smile on his face.
We'll have to cut. We'll discuss it in the beginning of the episode. But yeah, if you're following along with us, folks, please read or reread. In this case, The Rats in the Walls. It's a terrific tale. Oh my god, it makes my skin crawl every time I read it. Ken, I can't wait to see what you think of this one.
I'm ready.
And yeah, that's what we're doing next time. So yeah, man, I think that's that's what we got for the Lurking Fear. Yeah, well, thank you for joining us this episode of Learning Lovecraft. I've been Jason McKittrick.
And I've been Ken James.
And we'll see you beyond the wall of sleep.